Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I am really excited to be in conversation today with actor, director, and producer Peter Egert. Before he decided he wanted to pursue a career as an actor, Peter Egert marked time in a series of jobs from teaching eighth grade to waiting tables. Soon after settling on show business, the Bronx native joined the improvisational comedy troupe War Babies, where he obtained his equity card playing Chico Marx in the stage musical Minnie's Boys. Peter went on to appear in several theatrical productions, including the 1976 off-Broadway hit Sexual Perversity in Chicago by David Mamet. After appearing in the short, A Director Talks About His Film, Egert made his feature film debut as one of the denizens of National Lampoon's Animal House in 1978. You all remember that. Some of his other movies include Local Hero, Crossing Delancey, I love that one, Chilly Scenes of Winter, Cold-Blooded, Oscar, Passed Away, The Mask, Traffic, White Irish Drinkers, and the short films The Walk and The Response. Peter Egert's television credits include The Sopranos, Damages, Gypsy, Barbarians at the Gate, Concealed Enemies, Law and Order, SVU, The Good Wife, and One Tree Hill. On Broadway, he was in The Old Neighborhood, An American Daughter, The Nerd and Dance With Me. Off-Broadway includes previously mentioned Sexual Perversity in Chicago, The Birthday Party, Mountain Language, Isn't It Romantic, and A Rosen by Any Other Name. His directorial film debut was the Academy-nominated short by Courier, followed by his first feature, King of the Corner, with Isabella Rossellini, Eli Wallach, Rita Moreno, Beverly D'Angelo, and Dominic Chianese. He played Oscar Newman in David Simon's miniseries for HBO, Show Me a Hero, based on Lisa Belkin's nonfiction book of the same name, directed by Paul Haggis. He plays Artie Goodman in Tina Fey's Netflix show, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and played opposite Kathy Bates in her show, Disjointed, also for Netflix. We'll talk about all of that with the amazing Peter Egert, about so much more than his acting, but first, welcome Peter Egert.
Thanks very much. I didn't know I had a career.
Well, not only do you have a career, but you are a hero in the Berkshires, where I just saw you being honored at BIFF, the Berkshire International Film Festival. Peter, you are a Bronx boy. What'd your parents do?
My dad was a poultry wholesaler, worked in Greenwich Village on, Washington and Gansfort.
Oh.
Washington and Horatio Street. Mm-hmm. And my mom taught piano and tried to help my sister Eleanor and I grow into adulthood.
Did you play the piano?
It didn't take for me. My mother tried. I went to a conservatory in White Plains. We moved from the Bronx when I was about 7 and a half to a town called Ardsley. I went to the Ardsley school system. I think our address was Hartsdale, but I basically grew up in that town, Ardsley, for 10 years. So I went to a conservatory, and it just didn't stick. I studied the clarinet for a while. That didn't take. I remember seeing an interview with Isaac Stern, the great violinist, and he was asked by the interviewer, how do you become Isaac Stern? And he said, you have to be lucky enough to have parents who will sit with you for hours while you practice. And as much as my mom wanted me to play an instrument, she had plenty to do. So she used to say, if you could just sit for 15 minutes. And I had no idea what she was talking about. But once I became an actor, I kind of understood the idea of what practice meant. It wasn't even practice. Al Cooper, the great organist who played for Dylan on three of his albums and had his own bands like The Blues Project and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I asked him once about practicing. How long did you practice? Because he started out playing the guitar as well as the piano. He said, I didn't practice. I said, what do you mean you didn't practice? He said, we played. And I understood that a professional doesn't think of it as practice. It's just going to work. That's what you do. And you spend hours and hours and hours doing it. And it wasn't until I connected to what I do now as an actor or writer, director, that I got the conceit that it's not drudgery. It's actually invigorating.
You know, I agree with that. My band, The Satellites for Music Out of This World, when I was 16, 17, and 18, 19, 20, that's how you learn.
You play.
You play.
Yeah.
As opposed to standing there
that's
and playing scales.
That's right.
Yeah. So nature or nurture?
Both.
Is it both?
Oh, yeah, I think. You mean in just in terms general as human beings?
No, I mean in terms of your excellence as an actor.
Oh.
And I mean, how much of what you've achieved can you just say, that was in me somewhere?
Well, I think I have pretty good ears, which I would give to my mom. And I don't mean just as decorative to my head. I mean timing. And a sense of humor, I think, my dad. My dad and my mom, I could feel their influence. Whatever genes they passed on to me, I have no idea where that comes in. But everybody has talent, I think, and not even think, I believe.
Nah.
No, everybody has talent. How developed the talent becomes, that's where the nurture comes in. If you're lucky enough to be exposed to good people and interesting experiences, that will draw out of you even more of your talent. It's not just something that's dormant.
Well, we certainly don't agree on that.
Really? How so?
No, I mean, I have a friend, Peter. I'd been playing the banjo for 10 years, and Peter said to me one day, let me see that thing. He came back an hour later. He played better than I did.
But it doesn't mean you don't have talent.
Huh? No, I think some people have more natural talent and more natural ability.
I've met plenty of natural talent that's no longer doing what I do. So it's not just talent.
Oh, that's work.
Well, it's work. It's luck. I'm just saying that I used to be a bit snobbish about my opinions of what talent was or wasn't. And a friend of mine who was a cinematographer and an artist named Harry Hurwitz disavowed me of that. He said, people have talent. Whether it's of any value, only time can tell. I mean, stuff that I think is crap today, who knows in 100 years whether it'll be looked at as the greatest thing since chopped liver.
We're talking with the great Peter Riegert. Peter, let's go through your career. How did it all start? Where did it start?
Well, it literally started in terms of me making the commitment to do this as an epiphany. And I say that because I grew up in a household where I was being taken at a very early age to baseball games and circuses and rodeos and concerts for young people and eventually theater and then obviously movies and television, I think we got in maybe 1952, three.
You were late?
Yeah, pretty late.
Ours came 49.
Yeah, you were ahead of by years. So I would say all children, in my experience, play, have a sense of play. And for me, I'm sure I fantasized about being in a rodeo or being in a movie or being a baseball player. But none of it really stuck, as I said earlier about the piano, until I woke up January 1st, 1971. I had been working at a nightclub the night before, New Year's Eve, at a club in Manhattan called The Upstairs at the Downstairs, which used to be on 56th off of 6th Avenue.
And what were you doing?
I was serving drinks. I got a job serving drinks for New Year's Eve. And I think I made $75 in tips. And
that's
in 1971, that was a lot of money. And it was cash, which made it even more money. And I woke up the next day. My memory is that I was at my folks' place. They used to live on West End Avenue and 75th Street.
By that time, they had come from Ardsley to...
Yeah, they moved back to Manhattan in 70.
And on what street was that?
They were on West End and 75th.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the Schwab House?
Literally across from the Schwab House. Good memory. Well, you're an Upper West Sider, so you know.
I am.
Anyway, I don't remember why. I used to live in the Village on Horatio Street, so why I ended up at my parents' place, I can only imagine it was maybe really snowy and cold, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was closer to my folks' place than to the Village. I didn't want to take a subway at that hour, I guess. And when my eyes popped awake, my first sentient thought was, I'm going to be an actor. I mean, it literally happened that way.
But why?
That's one of the great undiscovered questions.
I mean, you didn't see yourself acting when you were serving the drinks, did you?
No. I think it's kind of like creativity. Where do creative ideas come from? So if that, as I said, I call it an epiphany, but if I had that kind of, it was so clear, the message, you know, it wasn't like I heard voices because it was me. I could hear myself saying, I'm going to be an actor. And it just was the clearest thought to me. Now, everybody has inspiration, but I was loony enough to start doing it. And I called a couple of friends who I knew from the University of Buffalo, where I graduated in 68, one of whom I think was Ronnie Silver, if I remember correctly. Anyway, I called him up and I said, I'm going to do this. And he'd already begun his career. I think it was Ronnie. And I said, how do you do this? And he explained the process of auditioning. I vaguely knew that you auditioned, but I didn't know, you know. I said, where do you find this out? And he said, well, there's newspapers. There's show business papers. One is called Show Business. One is called, I can't even remember what they call, Variety, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he said, you look in the back, and there's ads for where there are auditions. And you bring a picture and a resume. And I said, what's a picture and a resume? They said, well, a picture, you know, a picture. I said, a picture of me, right? He said, yeah, but, you know, your face, your head. It's called a headshot. I said, where do you get that? He said, well, find somebody with a camera, take a picture, and make 50 copies. And I said, well, and what's the resume? He said, a resume of your work. I said, what work? I've never acted. I'm just beginning. He said, well, you make it up. I said, make what up? He said, make your resume up. I said, well, I did a play in high school and a play in college. He said, okay, put those two down and then make up, invent a theater company, put it in an obscure small town in any state in the country and give yourself a part. I said, what do you mean? He said, the Jiminy Cricket players in Podunk, Idaho, or wherever that Podunk is, Iowa, and you played Laertes in Hamlet, and you just keep filling it up with these fake theater names. And I said, so I should lie? Everybody lies? He said, Peter, we're actors. We lie professionally. Don't worry about it. Just make it up. I said, well, won't the people who are auditioning me know, won't they check? He said, they know you're lying. You're too young to have any experience. It's all a game. Everybody plays this game. Don't worry about it. So my feeling after thinking about this was, well, if everybody's lying, why don't I tell the truth? And what did the truth look like was a whole blank page. I listed my high school performance. I played the Archbishop in Romanoff and Juliet, which is a play by Peter Ustinov. And I listed another play in college that I did with Ronnie Silver and Steve Sunshine. And I played Hoffi, the barracks leader, in Stalag 17. So those are my two real credits. Everything was blank. And then at the bottom of the page, I had been Bella Abzug's aide-de-camp when she ran against Leonard Farbstein in 1970. So I put that down. And my feeling was, this is in my own imagination, maybe the blank page will provoke a conversation and repartee because I'm not going to get hired because of my experience, but maybe I can charm my way into a job. And I started January 2nd because the first, no, nothing was happening.
And what year was this?
1971.
Okay.
So January 2nd, my first audition was in a basement in a brown house on 4th Avenue and 4th Street. It was so cold. There was no heat. There was snow coming in the windows. And there were 200 young people auditioning for these various parts. And I just kept thinking, this is show business? And of course, it is. And I'd say in 6 weeks, I had gotten a job from a theater company called the Omni Theater on 18th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue. And they called me up and said, we've decided to hire you. And I said, oh, didn't I audition for you on January 10th or 15th? And they said, yeah, but that actor, we've started rehearsal and that actor left for another job, so we'd like you to play the part. I said, oh, I don't have to audition? They said, no, we remember you and we'll hire you. So you didn't get paid any money because it was off Broadway. So I go in and I meet these very nice people. And eventually I said, so how did I get this job? And they said, well, you made us laugh so hard and your resume was so absurdly lacking in any experience. And you seemed completely at ease that you had no experience. We just thought that aspect of you matched up to the nature of this particular character.
So what you thought was going to happen actually happened?
That actually happened. And I realized that the reasons you get a job are literally impossible to determine. But if you go in with the attitude that you're, well, it all depends. I mean, even when I used to go in and audition, auditioning was always an anxiety-provoking thing, and I had to try and analyze it. Why am I anxious about this? And it's because I wanted the job. And I had to trick myself. I had to come up with a better way of going into the audition. And so what I said to myself was, instead of going to get the job, why don't you go as if you have the job and that the audition is actually the first day of rehearsal? And if they want to fire you, they'll fire you. But basically, take neediness out of the reason that you're going there. And that helped a lot, too.
So let's bring it on. When did you know it was going to be okay?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I don't think you ever know that it's going to be okay. There are just signs along the way that tell, at least for me, that told me to keep going. And I would say in the beginning, let me check in with myself in 6 months. And have I done anything? Is the work interesting? Who am I working with? And I worked on a job in that first year. I think the actor's name was Sam Affamato. I give him credit for this. So, Sam, if you're listening, thank you. Anyway, he took me out for drinks one day because he was fascinated with my wet behind the ears approach, because I didn't go to acting school, so I didn't have any particular vocabulary. So he took me out for drinks and he said, let me ask you something. Are you aware of the fact that you have this job? I said, what do you mean? He said, because you're rehearsing as if you're trying to get the job. You have the job. Don't worry about it. And I said to him, okay, I think I understand what that means. I said, let me ask you something. How will I know if I'm getting better? And he said something brilliant. He said, look around at the people you're working with. If you notice they're getting better, believe me, you're getting better. Nobody gives anybody a job out of mercy. This is a cutthroat, vicious business. If the people around you are improving, you're improving.
So we hear all of these things. You know, the Actor's Studio, right. You didn't have that.
I didn't have that, no. I had graduated college in 68. I had my degree as an English major. And I had done some work as a social worker. I wasn't a social worker, but my mentors were social workers for the University Settlement House on the Lower East Side.
I know it well.
It was the first settlement of the country in 1886, actually. And I also worked as a teacher in 1968 for a year and a half at IS 271 in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, during the big school strike back then. So my dad said to me, once I told him my epiphany, he said, would you like us to help you go to acting school? And I said, Dad, I can't take your money anymore. I just can't do it. I've got to figure this out for myself. And I have enough of a stubborn streak in me, which I knew I would pay a penalty for as well as be rewarded for. So I just thought, I will treat this as if it's an apprenticed profession, and I will find my mentors along the way. So I didn't, by design, go to acting school. I knew I would lose something by not going, but also it would give me something else. I didn't know what that was going to be, but that was my MO, actually.
So who did you pass on the way? Did you pass, you know, the Marlon Brandos and the others? I mean, who were the ones who you said, whoa?
You know, I'll tell you two stories that'll give you an idea of my instinct. I was doing a play at this Omni Theater, and I didn't have an agent. That was the big question. How are you going to get an agent? Because you needed an agent, sure, to get an audition. And, I mean, a professional audition. And I had a girlfriend who, at the time, I said, listen, Ellen, do you know anybody who makes a living doing this? Because it's nice that friends and family think I'm talented, but I got to get somebody in here who actually is paid for doing this. I need
an agent.
I don't need an agent. I just need somebody who's a professional.
I see.
So that I could tell whether this is a pipe dream or I should keep going. So she said, I know somebody who's a director. And he does mostly commercials, but he works with lots of famous actors and actresses. I said, would you invite him? And she said, yes. So he said he would come. And she said, when would you like him to come to the play? I said, well, we open on blah, blah, blah nights. The worst thing you ever want to do is invite anybody to the first performance of anything, especially a theater, and an under-rehearsed play because you're doing off Broadway. So this guy comes the opening night. I don't even think we wore makeup back then because the audiences were like 25 people and they were as close as me to you right now. So I finish, I see Ellen. I said, did he show up? She said, yeah, he's over there. He's that guy in that shirt. I said, oh, I'll be right back. And I walked up and learned a very early lesson. So I said to him, I introduced myself and I said, hi, thanks so much for coming. What did you think? Another question you should never ask anybody, unless you want an answer. So he immediately said, this is the worst acted, worst written, worst directed piece of crap I've ever seen. And you should get yourself out of here as fast as possible. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I just wanted your opinion. I didn't want you to cut my head off. So I absorbed that. And I really didn't know what he was talking about. But I sensed, obviously, this was the wrong person to ask any advice about. 2 weeks later, same play, essentially the same performance. A young actress named Debbie White introduced herself. She said, hi, I'm Debbie White. And I said, nice to meet you. She said, you are so talented. I'm part of a workshop in which we do improvisational theater games. Would you like to become a member? And I knew a little bit of improv from the Compass Players and Nichols and May and Alan Arkin and all of that history out of Chicago and New York City. And I immediately said, absolutely. So in the same experience, I got the worst advice possible and the greatest encouragement possible. And it was the same play. And I was in that workshop 2 days later, 3 months later, we were performing professionally under the name War Babies. And I was with that group for 8 years.
Wow.
Performing once a week, at least every week for 8 years. And that's how I learned how to act.
We're talking to the great Peter Riegert. There are so many things we want to ask you about. An hour is going to be tough to do so much of it in. Okay, so there you are. You're in this improv group. How does that evolve?
We just were working as a workshop, and the same actress that I mentioned, Debbie White, had gone off to audition at the Manhattan Theater Club when it was really in its infancy in the early 70s. And there was somebody there auditioning actors and actresses to become part of an improvisational company. So that night at our workshop, Debbie came back and said, listen, I just auditioned for this performance improv company. Why don't we do that? We're really good. Why don't we start our own company? And there were about 15 or 20 of us in the workshop. And most of them, about 10 of them wanted to do it. The other 5 to 10, it was really more of an exercise. The idea of performing improvs in front of an audience was too scary for them. So relatively quickly, we all agreed. There were people in the group who had been folk singers and comedians, so they knew various places. We found a theater, a club called the Focus Coffee House. It was a coffee house, Focus Coffee House on 74th Street, just east of Amsterdam Avenue. And I say end of June, June 22nd, 3rd, we started performing. And it was exhilarating. And we just kept going.
Did you make money?
The first money we made, 4 of us, it was Marsha Myers, Brenny Temple, and John Welsh. We were invited through a contact Marsha had made with a temple in Riverdale. And they were going to give us, all 4 of us, $25. So I was going to make...
$25 for everybody?
No, total. So I was going to make $6.50. $6.25, even better. So we went there and performed. They didn't even use our name. Whoever hired us, they referred to us as Marsha and her men, which was, of course, ridiculous. And most of the subject matter had to do with either Jewish subjects or locations or names. And, of course, the two non-Jews in the group, Rennie and John, we would generally work around who, what, and where's. Who are the people, where are they, and what's the activity? So they were given 2 rabbis. So Marsh and I are hysterical because we know we're about to witness the worst non-Jewish Jews you've ever seen. But that was the first money I ever made.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, we were told, our producer David Cassina and I were told by Pete Seeger, that when the Weavers first started, that they were paid in hamburgers.
Oh, and I don't think that is wildly out of reality. I mean, that's true. And when you're young and starting out, $4, $6.25, that's real money.
Okay, so what happened next?
So the improv group is performing, and Marsha, in 1973, I still didn't have an agent yet. I couldn't get an agent. I had been making what they call the rounds. I would go to different agencies, and I would bring this picture and this resume, which was still pretty empty, and it was pretty clear pretty quickly that I'm not going to get an agent this way. It's not going to happen. If I get an agent, it's going to be getting a job and somebody's going to walk in and that's how it's going to be. And I always, in my demented point of view, I was always looking for the most economical way to achieve the greatest result. And sometimes just giving resumes to people who really were going to throw it in the garbage can, I didn't want to do that. So the next important experience was some of the actors had been represented by an entertainment lawyer. And one of those lawyers was a gentleman named Egon Dumbler, since passed away. But he came up to me after one of the improv shows, maybe 6 months in. And he said, can I take you to lunch? I'd say, sure. He said, I'm an entertainment lawyer and I'd like to talk to you about representing you. And so we went to lunch and I said, listen, Egon, I'm really flattered, but I don't have any money. And he said, well, I think you will. And that's somebody who was living off of the percent that they would make. And here was a total stranger saying, I think you're going to have a career. So that was as effervescent a feeling that I could have, that kind of encouragement, almost more than anything else. Because this was a guy who was telling me that he wanted to work with me.
But he wasn't an agent. He was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer, a theatrical lawyer, yeah. Which was, you know, in the neighborhood. I was getting closer. But, you know, he's working on commission, and commission on nothing is still nothing. So that gave me a boost. That was some wind behind my sails, as they say. And then sometime in the spring of 73, Marcia Myers from the improv group had invited a friend of hers named Louis Stadlin, who had starred as Groucho in Minnie's Boys in 1970. And there was a tour. There was going to be a 10-week tour of Minnie's Boys. And Marcia said, let me invite Louis. And maybe Louis, if he likes you, will recommend you to the producers of this tour. So Louis Stadlin came, and we hit it off. And he indeed set up an audition for me to play Groucho, or to audition to play Groucho. And nothing happened. And about, I'd say, the beginning of August of 1973, I get a call from the producer of this Minnie's Boys tour, which is now 2 weeks, not 10 weeks. And they call up and say, we'd like to offer you the part of Chico. And I said, I thought I was auditioning for Groucho. They said, well, Louis Stadlin's going to play Groucho, but we'd like to offer you the part of Chico. I said, well, when's the audition? They said, no, we're not going to audition you. We'd like you to play the part of Chico. We're giving you this part. Oh, okay. You know, it's not sinking into me yet that this is going to be my first professional job. I'm going to get my actor's equity card from this job. And I don't sing, and this is a musical. So he said, how soon can you get to the rehearsal? I said, where's the rehearsal? He said, 50th Street and 8th Avenue. I said, well, I've got to, you know, jump in the shower and clean up a bit here. And I said, I think I can get there in about 45 minutes to an hour. They said, perfect. So I hang up the phone, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is a job. This is like a job. Okay, so I take a shower and get ready and get dressed, and I hop on the bus. I don't even take a taxi because I need time to figure out, how do you play Chico? Groucho I could do, but Chico I hadn't even thought about. So on the bus ride up, I'm thinking, well, they're all brothers. Well, what the hell? I'll do Groucho with an Italian accent. So I get to the rehearsal, and they say, we're on page 22. Here's you. They push me into the rehearsal. We had 5 days of rehearsal because Irwin Pearl, who's since passed away, was playing Chico, and he had gotten ill. And that's how many days I had to prepare. Now, I have a pretty good ear, but I'm not a singer. I have no experience doing that. I mean, I sing in the shower or maybe with friends, but they never asked me to sing. It was only the rehearsal of the play. I mean, we did some rehearsing, obviously, of the songs, but I didn't sing in front of a piano player for a while. The show was in Philadelphia Playhouse in the Park, 1,600 people in the round. And that was my introduction to professional theater. I got $325 a week and my equity card.
That wasn't bad, $325 a week.
Well, it seemed like a million because I'd only been working for nothing. So my thought is, well, I know what nothing is, but what's $325 worth of acting? How do you measure that? Do you divide 325 by 8 and it's about $40? Sure. Nonsensical questions that are unanswerable.
But I wanted to ask you a diversionary question that we'll come back to.
Sure.
This, and that is, do you eat chicken?
I love chicken.
Oh, because your father
was in the chicken. Oh, yeah. We were a classic meat and potatoes family.
Did he bring a chicken home?
He didn't bring a chicken home. He didn't want to be, you know, snoring chickens for his family. But every year he gave a turkey to various people in various worlds that made life a little easier. For example, there was a doorman who used to be a police captain in the New York Police Department.
Really?
Who was a doorman at one of the theaters in New York City on Broadway. And every year he would give him a turkey. And whenever my father wanted tickets, he'd call up this guy and he would get tickets for my father. They'd have to pay.
Yeah, sure.
But he could make a reservation for my dad.
Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it was the barter system. We would go to a ball game. We'd go to, you know, whether it was the Polo Grounds or Yankee Stadium, and we would buy tickets, or he would buy tickets all the way up in the third upper deck. And every inning or two, he would give a dollar to the ushers, and we'd make our way down closer and closer to the field because he would tip his way to the...
That's great.
Yeah, he's a very imaginative guy.
Well, Peter Riegert, we don't have that much time. Okay. It's killing me. So let me start by asking you certain interstitial questions, and you'll tell us how you got there.
Sure.
Okay. The one that everybody, of course, remembers from the very beginning is Animal House. How did that happen?
Well, Animal House was 77, so I had been acting for 6 years.
Wow.
And I had found my way west with my girlfriend at the time, who was, you may have heard of this singer actress Bette Midler. Anyway, we were together and we ended up in California. My improv group had meanwhile left New York and gone to California, so I had them to continue playing with. I did a play out there, and I had gotten 2 episodes of MASH, which was an introduction to working with professionals.
Who were you?
I played a character named Igor, who had been played by a very tall actor.
I remember.
So I did 2 episodes, and they never changed the name of the character, but I still was Igor.
Was
but
Igor
I got to
a cook?
He was a cook. I think you're right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Very good, Alan. Very impressive. Anyway, I did 2 episodes, and I got to work with Alan Alda and everybody else and watched these people having the time of their life, screwing up their lines and making mistakes. And, of course, all I knew was I've got to be perfect. I cannot screw up. I'm the guest. They don't have time for me to bumble around. Not that I had that much to do, but it was a chance to really hear, you know, roll camera, blah, 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 sound, action, and cut. And it was just thrilling because it was another introduction. I did, in the same year, I played an intern in the movie Coma, written and directed by Michael Crichton. And I had a mask over my face. It starred Michael Douglas and Genevieve Bugeaud. And it's in the opening scene when the first murders take place. And all I had was my eyes and a mask. So I did as much eye acting, the worst kind of acting you could do. And then I got, through my agent, Eddie Bondi, at the William Morris. This is leaping ahead. It's a long story how I got to the William Morris. But anyway, I was with William Morris. And Eddie was my agent. Most amazing guy. Unbelievable guy. And agent. And I, like thousands of other young men, were auditioning for this thing called Animal House. I remember about 4 auditions. My first memory was auditioning with Tim Matheson, in which we improvised together after going through the lines.
You're how old now?
I'm 71, so I was 29 then. Oh, you mean then?
Then, yeah.
29, I was 29.
Yeah. Okay. So you're...
Or 30. Was I 30? 1976. I was 30. Yeah.
I don't care. So they brought you back 4 times?
I think by the 3rd time I had the job. I didn't know that yet. And then I auditioned with Karen Allen. They asked me to audition with Karen and another actress to play the part of Katie, which I did. And John Landis, the director, asked my opinion. And I said, look, I can't tell you who's the more talented, but it seems to me Karen is the person you want to go with.
Hey, Paula, I want to marry you. Hey, Paula, nobody else could ever do. I waited so long for school to get through, Paula. I can't wait no more for you.
And she has been, as we all know now, Peter Riegert, a lifelong friend.
Yeah, a pal since that, as many of the others have been. Yeah, yeah. It was an experience that I took with me to this day.
Okay, help us savor this and unfold it. So you play the part.
Right.
Then what happens?
We shot it in 7 weeks. We had a week of rehearsal, even though we didn't do any rehearsing. And then we had 6 weeks of shooting, about 30 days. The whole process began, I guess, the middle of October and ended the first week in December. And then life went on, and 8 months later, they had some sneak previews, and that did very well.
Do they pay you as you're going, or do you have to wait till the movie comes out?
No, that you get paid before.
Right.
You get paid before, and every contract is different, as you can imagine. And there are things you have to do at the end of the movie where you might have to rework your voice.
I see.
And that comes later. That could be 3 months later, 6 months later, whatever they want you for. And then you do publicity. But I'll tell you a fun story. Eddie, whose nickname was Eddie Bookum Dead or Alive Bondi, because he once booked a woman who'd been dead for 6 months, and he didn't know it, he got me this job. I got the job, but he got me the audition. And when it was time to negotiate, now I had just left doing a play in New York City that I did for 8 months called Sexual Perversity in Chicago that was written by this new kid named David Mamet. And I was making between $110 and $160 a week, which to me was a fortune. My rent was $95, so $110 a week, that's pretty good money. I mean, I could pay the bills, I paid the rent, and I could save a dollar or two. So for Animal House, I was paid $1,000 for each week. Now, why I got $1,000, I don't know. But this is how naive I was. I kept thinking, $1,000? Wait a second. I'm one of the leading guys. Shouldn't I be making more? Because I'm like everybody else. You think Hollywood and you think money. So I said to Eddie, Eddie, shouldn't I be making more money? I'm one of the leading guys. He said, yes, of course you should be making more money. But you're not going to make more money because you've never made a movie before. I said, what do you mean? I have nothing to negotiate. You've never done a movie. When this movie is over, we'll hope that it's a success. And if you're good, you'll get more work. But this is the only money you're going to get.
Were there residuals in those days?
Yes. No, there were residuals. So I said to Eddie, but I've been doing the theater. I've been doing lots of theater. And I just came from the theater. And I've been doing the theater. And he said, Peter, this is Hollywood. In Hollywood, the theater is where they show the movies, you idiot. Don't worry about it. Be a good actor and maybe the movie will be a hit. So that's how that began. 8 months later, it opened in end of July of 1978, and we were off to the races.
And how did you know it was going to be a hit?
Only because of the audience's reaction, because nobody knows. The most famous line out of Hollywood is from the great screenwriter and novelist William Goldman, who coined the phrase, nobody knows anything. He didn't mean nobody knows anything technically. He just means nobody knows what's going to happen. Because you make a movie, 8 months later, the world can turn. It's very much like politics. Nobody knows anything.
Exactly. So how did you deal with fame?
I only had the experience of recognition in New York City because of the theater. So you're only being recognized if anybody's hanging around after the play. Or maybe you'll coincidentally meet somebody on the bus,
but
you're not really performing for, you know, maybe Broadway, it's 800 people, 1,000 people, but off-Broadway, it's 150, 250, that's a lot of people. So I wasn't even aware of what fame was. I was aware of what recognition was. But I had a chance to learn about fame through watching Bella Abzug when I was working as her aide-de-camp, because she was a brilliant politician. She was incredibly smart, but she understood that politics was theater, and she worked that way. And then when I was with Bette, who was really starting to become incredibly successful and famous, watching her deal with fame taught me something interesting.
Well, do you have to be humble?
You know, I don't know if it's that. Everybody has to figure it out, because after Animal House came out, I was recognized, as you can imagine, daily, everywhere, anywhere, planes, subways, buses, restaurants, going shopping, walking the streets. It was so overwhelming that it freaked me out. And I was in California with my group, and I told them, I said, I have to take a month off. They said, why? I said, because I'm not comfortable on stage anymore. They said, well, why? I said, I feel paranoid. I feel like people are looking at me. And they said, of course they're looking at you, you idiot. You're an actor. They're looking at you. I said, no, that the fourth wall has broken for me. I can't stop thinking about them looking at me. Just give me a month. I just got to put this new success in perspective because it's really screwing with my head.
Did you come back?
Yeah, about a month later. I just had to realize that it didn't mean anything. It just came with the territory.
Wow. Okay, so let's go to the next one, which I love so much, and you'll put it into historical perspective, and that's Crossing Delancey.
Actually, the biggest next one for me was Local Hero. That was 83, but Crossing Delancey was 88, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I know, I'm jumping
that's
way
okay.
ahead.
Sure, sure.
And that's only because I have 14 minutes and I want to make it count.
Sure.
So Crossing Delancey, tell me about making that, and tell me whether you have to associate with the story at all.
I don't believe you have to associate with any story. to me, it's if you connect to the material, you'll figure it out. But you don't have to come from any particular place. You don't have to relate specifically from your life to the part. Otherwise, you're going to be limited in the kinds of parts you're going to
play. Remind us what the story was.
Crossing Delancey is the story of a woman played by Amy Irving, whose grandmother, played by a Yiddish actress at the time named Rachel Buzhik, who was in the Yiddish theater.
The perfect name.
Perfect name. And she had actually never been in a movie or had ever spoken English as an actress. She came from Poland with her husband in 1940 to 41 to Argentina. Anyway, those two people were the granddaughter and the grandmother, and the grandmother hires a matchmaker to find her granddaughter a date, which turns out to be me, who runs a pickle stand on the Lower East Side.
I love that movie.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. I like it a lot. Coincidentally, I had mentioned earlier that I had worked...
Now, the granddaughter had pretensions of grandeur, right? Not wanting to be involved with a pickle dealer.
Well, I just wanted to stop by and tell you how much I appreciated the gesture.
Sure it fits. Finkel said you could take it back, no problem.
It was a lovely thing to do.
And if you want, I can go with you. You can go by yourself if you're more comfortable. 423 Delancey.
It fits.
You don't need a receipt, he said.
It fits.
Good. Looks great.
Is this the one?
Meg! Mickey!
Look, I don't want to keep you.
Are you a nurse?
Let me go across the street for some coffee.
Sam, I don't want to do this. I just came by to thank you. That's all. I'm really very, very flattered. You know, you ought to take all that good romantic energy that you have, and it is good. It's creative and refreshing, and it won't go unappreciated on the right woman. I wish there were a way that I could say this.
You did fine.
Yeah, she had been infatuated with another writer, played by Jeroen Krabbe, who's a wonderful Dutch actor. Anyway, it's a classic love story where, in this case, it's a woman has a choice between two men, and clearly she's making the wrong choice, and the audience is rooting for her to choose
me. Don't do that, don't do that.
That's right. It's a perfectly suspenseful construction in which the audience knows what's going to happen, and they get to, you know, root for the person to make the right decision, even while they're making the wrong one.
How do you put yourself into the pickle guy's persona? You know, the method,
Do
you do any of that?
I don't do any of that. I mean, the method is a brilliant marketing term. To call your particular method the method, everybody has a method. Some people bring a method with no schooling. Some people bring a method from another school. You've got to figure it out. And believe me, the best people I've worked with, actors or actresses or directors or writers, they could give a crap where you studied. On the day that you show up, you've got to bring it, and nobody cares where you studied. Anyway, my experience with The Pickle Man was Susan Sandler, who wrote the play that the movie's based on, sent me the play, or her casting director did, and I couldn't do it at the time. I
was Stop. Just before we go any further,
yeah,
in case you're just joining us, too bad for you, go get this out at WAMC.org. We're talking to Peter Riegert. Go ahead, Peter.
Okay. So Susan sent me the play, Susan Sandler, and I couldn't do it. I had a conflict, and she was very sweet. She wrote me a postcard and said, well, maybe you'll get to do the movie. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure this play is going to become a movie, but thank you so much. Lo and behold, 2 years later, Joan...
But it is sort of right out of Yiddish theater, isn't it? I remember going to...
It was done as a play. This is the kind of story construction
you would see.
Well, it's a classically constructed play. It could be done in Yiddish, Italian, French, German.
Okay, go ahead.
So Joan Micklin Silver, sent me the script before they even had the money, and she said, I'd like you to play Sam, the pickle man. And I said, yeah, absolutely. I read the script. Joan is a fantastic screenwriter, and she casts her movies brilliantly.
Now, but this time, are you negotiating money?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of money, but, you know, in those days, well, any day, money isn't the determining... I mean, I'm not an idiot. I'd like to make as much money as possible. Right. But sometimes a job is more important than the money.
Sure.
Because it's going to do something for your life in ways that you can't even imagine. And I just thought this was a fantastic love story. And this character was such a mensch. It was irresistible. And then eventually Amy Irving came on and they raised the money and we shot it. I think it was October of 87 till the end of that year, and it came out in 88. And of course, the challenge of playing a mensch, which essentially is a human being, is that a mensch, by definition, is unselfconscious. And as an actor, you're always self-conscious. So how do I learn how to let go of that? And that was really the challenge. But the cast was so good, and Joan was such a terrific director. And, you know, your performance in the movie or television show is sculpted by the editor and the director, because they're choosing how much you're going to be seen. And a lot of what I do in Crossing Delancey is reactive to what's happening around me. And I've always been very fortunate that directors have found my listening ability as valuable as my dialogue interpretation. Anyway, the movie came out, and it wasn't Animal House success, but it was very successful. It made probably 5 times what it cost. And I've never been more propositioned in my life than playing that pickle man. Everywhere I went, mothers, grandmothers, girlfriends, sisters were trying to set me up with somebody. So that was kind of fun.
Well, let's spend a little time on your, because we could go through the entire list of all the things. Let's take a little time on your post full-time acting. You're doing a very interesting thing now. What are you doing?
I still write and produce and direct, or try to. I've directed a short, I directed a feature. I optioned a book by a fantastic writer named Cornelia Reed. She writes crime fiction. And I optioned her first book, which is called A Field of Darkness. And I optioned it in 2005. I didn't get the movie made. I wrote a screenplay, but now Cornelia and I live together. So I didn't get a movie. I got a girlfriend, which was really fantastic. So she's written 3 more books in the crime fiction genre, but she's a great novelist, I think, around the character Madeline Dare. So it's now gone from a movie to clearly it wants to be on cable television, because each year could be a novel. So I'm working on that. I'm working on a screenplay that I'm trying to finish, and I have an idea for a comedy for television, also probably for cable. And Cornelia and I started an Airbnb up in Dutchess County.
No, that's where I was going.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we have that in common.
Yeah.
We have, but ours is only one little building with one little room.
Yeah.
So how's that going?
Well, we just started. I rented out my apartment in New York. I have a place on 71st and West End. And we've been spending more time up in Dutchess County. It's in Hyde Park, in that area. When I bought the property, there were about 4 young people who were renting this guest house. And they were paying 40% of the cost of the whole thing. So I thought, oh, my God, they're practically giving me this thing. Anyway, we made the deal. The people who were renting the guest house stayed for about 1.5 years. They moved out. We tried to rent it. And then we just said, why don't we try this Airbnb thing? So we put it up the end of April. And we're now booked through August. And we're starting to take people for September, October, and
onward. Okay. Now comes that moment when somebody arrives, they've rented the Airbnb, and they show up, and all of a sudden, they look at your face and say, don't I know you from somewhere?
Well, this goes back to your question about fame. Most of them show up and say, thanks for letting us rent your house. They haven't a clue who I am, which is really fantastic. But eventually, something, you know, there's a couple of people who figure it out, but I'm not there to sell my career to, you know, I don't advertise me.
Well, but you're Peter Riegert. I'm Alan Chartok. Trust me, they come to our little thing and they take a look and they say, well, what's your name again, Alan Chartok?
Well, they wrote Noise Radio.
I know that name a little bit.
We're just Peter and Cornelia.
You don't talk careers with them?
No. I mean, there are people.
Don't they ever say, well, what do you do?
They do, on occasion. It happens. We try to leave people their place. They're there to rent the place. And, you know,
it's always a balance. You're right.
Yeah, we welcome them and we'll say goodbye when they leave. And it's really to help make them enjoy themselves. If somebody stumbles upon, you know, who I am or who Cornelia is, because we let them know we're in the movie business and the writing.
They go back in that house and they Google you immediately.
If they clock me, they will. The names of the rooms, all the bedrooms, are named after characters in Harold Pinter's play, The Birthday Party, which is a play that I did with Harold Pinter, actually, for the 30th anniversary of the play. That was exhilarating. So the rooms are called Monty, Goldberg, and McCann, named after these 3 characters. Well, actually, Monty is a character off stage. And we have, I don't know if you remember, in Animal House, Tim Matheson is on his way to try and get a date at Emily Dickinson College with Fawn Leibowitz, who has, you know, died in a kiln explosion.
Can I help you?
Well, I'm here to pick up my date. Could you ring Fawn Leibowitz for me?
Fawn Leibowitz? Just a minute. Hello, Shelley. This is Brunella at the desk. Could you come down here? Now. Because a boy just came in to pick up Fawn, that's why. Thank you.
Is she coming down?
Her roommate is. Fawn isn't here. She... Would you excuse me a minute? Hi, I'm Shelley Dubinsky, Fawn's roommate.
Hi, I'm Frank Lyman from Amherst, Fawn's fiancé. Well, actually, we're engaged to be engaged. What's the matter with everyone around here?
Why don't we sit down, Frank? I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to tell you. Fawn's dead.
She's dead? Did she put you up to this? Oh, that minx. What a lively sense of humor. Sophomore dies in kiln explosion? Oh, my God.
Oh, I'm terribly, terribly sorry, Frank.
I just talked to her last week. She was going to make a pot for me.
Anyway, we have a monument next to this waterfall, which is to Fawn Leibowitz, who, you know, lost her life throwing pots. And we named the property Furness after the town and local hero that I made.
If somebody wants to rent it, how do they get you? They want to.
I guess
Airbnb.
If you go to Dutchess County
and then go Airbnb.
On Airbnb.
Yeah.
If you look up Dutchess County Airbnb, I think we're under a Hudson Valley Getaway, I think it's called. So we're having a great time taking care of this property. And Cornelia writes, and she has an antiques business. And I write, and I'm a city mouse, so this is a new experience. But for the last 2.5 years, it's been a lot of fun. And having a place like this is like having an exotic pet.
Yeah.
You just have to take care of it all the time, which I like. I'm really enjoying it. The first night we stayed there, I woke up, it was in November, so it was pitch black when we got to the house and got the keys and everything and did the closing. And woke up the next day, and all the leaves are off the trees. I have no idea what we have. My first thought was, oh, my God, I'm the super. And a friend of mine said, no, you're not the super. You're the contractor. You're going to hire the people who are going to fix this place.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you
sometimes
don't.
Sometimes you do.
Yeah. Peter Riegert, of course, everybody watched The Sopranos. How'd that come about?
I had an audition for the part of Gandolfini's therapist. No, it wasn't the... It was the therapist's therapist. Anyway, I didn't get that job. And I was up in Toronto making a film. I can't remember what it was. But I got a call from David Chase saying, I have a part for you if you're interested to play a corrupt assemblyman. And again, it was an offer. So, you know, I was thrilled and delighted. I thought the show was pretty fantastic. And so I was hired. I did 6 episodes, 3 in the second season, 3 in the third season of this corrupt assemblyman.
Tony, what's going on? What's up? Look, I want to just calm down and be perfectly calm.
Well, we can talk about whatever's bothering you.
Yeah?
Tony, this is crazy.
Go! Tony!
Girls in New Jersey. What the this one?
Working with James Gandolfini was one of the great treats of my life as an actor. He was a mensch. What an amazing guy. Extraordinary actor. But as a human being, I can't say enough good things about him.
So do you have enough money to live on?
I'm paying the rent. And you know, it's funny. As an actor, it's almost 50 years that I'm doing this. It's always been robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I somehow have managed to keep going. And like I said, I have this fantastic penthouse apartment in New York City with a big old balcony. And I've got this place in the country. And I just wish my parents were around to see this. They'd really get a kick out of it.
Don't we all? That's a wonderful thought.
Yeah.
Okay, we've been in conversation today with actor, director, and producer Peter Riegert.
Peter, it's just been such a pleasure. We can't believe how lucky we are that you schlepped up all the way here and did this interview with us, because we're big fans. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really flattered to have been asked.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.